I'm David Suchet, and this is Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wonsall.
Hello, everyone. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for being there. Thank you for being interested in these stories of true crime. So, darling, what have you been doing? What have you got on the horizon?
I haven't got too much on at the moment, actually, which is a good thing. I don't have too many events and things to go to, just sort of like kicking into the year,
yep.
Trying to get on top of everything, get everybody working, you know, feeling focused, doing yep. Dry January, obviously, so very yeah. Sober.
My friend Jim Nocte is having a dry January as well. He's struggling like you.
Hey, no, I'm not struggling, she said. I'm struggling a little bit. It's good in lots of ways, though, because it's very focusing.
Very good. If that works, then I'm all for it. I haven't been doing anything nearly as serious. I've been just looking at endless dark stories.
How many? Your new series is out.
Yes,
everyone, don't forget to tune in to Jeffrey's new series of Murder by the Sea on CBS Reality.
And
sadly, I cannot watch it because my television is broken.
Oh, dear.
My Sky box is broken. I phoned Sky yesterday and they said, your dish is down. I said, I don't know where my dish is. And they said, it's a communal dish. I was like, I don't even know who I... He was like, call the building manager. I was like, I don't have a building manager. And he was like, call your landlord. I was like, my landlord lives in Los Angeles. I don't think he'll know where the Sky dish is or who else owns a Sky dish. So I'm without television. I can't watch you.
Oh,
I'm scuppered.
You can come around here.
On a side note, I will reach out for copies of those, then I can watch in my own time.
Yeah, there is some on catch-up.
I'm sure I can get the DVDs.
Well, I wouldn't mind the DVDs, as I haven't got any.
Okay, all right, well...
I had a sweet letter from someone this week who said, are there any DVDs? And I said, I don't really know, to be honest. He said, my wife and I love watching you in bed with a cup of tea and a biscuit.
Sorry? That's absolutely terrifying. They like watching you in bed with a cup of tea and a biscuit. Let's snuggle up for another murderous story hosted by Jeffrey Wonsall with a rich tea.
I thought it was very touching. I was very touched.
That's sweet. I'm a bit creepy.
No, I don't think it's creepy at all. I was very flattered.
Jeffrey's always joking because his show's repeated very late into the night, so we always wonder who it is that... And you get incredibly high viewing figures at like 3 a.m.
2 a.m., yeah. Yes, especially, well, the last series, they repeated at 2 a.m. on a Monday morning. Now they are repeating at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, the Saturday repeat of the Tuesday. They get four showings.
So that would be people who, I think that's people who just don't want to go to work on Monday and they just stay up incredibly late.
Yes. I wondered if it was people in shift work or, you know, I always imagine it's that chap as some kind of... caretaker in a box.
I don't think... Do they watch TV? People just have the internet now in those sorts of jobs, though, don't they? It's so different.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's stoners, Jeffrey's never adhered to this theory, but I feel strongly that it's people who stay up like late smoking weed.
Okay. It's a mystery to
not
me.
Convinced.
Anyway, it's the first of series four. The first two have aired, and we've got eight more to go.
At time of recording. This podcast.
At the time of recording.
By the time it comes out, more will have come out.
More will have come out, yep. And if you want to see them live, or as near live as it gets, the first showing is Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. CBS Reality. That's 148 on your Freeview.
Very good, very good.
You can get bits of them on catch-up as well. Anyway, darling, today we're going to deal with a very, very, very famous case.
Which I don't know, so it can't be that famous.
Well, believe me, I compare very few people to Bundy, but Rodney Alcala, I certainly do.
Are we giving him a name, or is he just Rodney Alcala?
No, he's called the Dating Game Killer.
The Dating Game Killer. Okay,
always known as the Dating Game Killer.
Here we go with the Dating Game Killer.
Yeah. He was a sexual predator of the worst and most abusive kind. And in a killing spree which lasted from 71 to 79, he attacked, I mean, countless women, arguably 50 plus, raping them, torturing them, bringing them back to life after he'd strangled them.
Where is this happening?
It's in Los Angeles. He was quite extraordinary. He was born in 1943 to a Mexican.
Is he around your age?
He would be just a bit older than me. He was born Rodrigo Jack Alcala Bugar. He was brought up, he was born in San Antonio. His father was a Spanish language instructor. Rodney Alcala was the third of four children. He had an older brother and sister and a younger sister. And in 1951, when Alcala was eight, the family moved to Mexico. When the family's grandmother got ill, she died. And in 1954, the family moved back to the USA and moved to LA from Texas. And at that point, Alcala's father abandoned them all. It was a good Catholic school. When he was 17, you know, stayed, good education, played the piano, ran for the school. All intents and purposes, and a perfectly ordinary young man. In August 1961, at 18, he wanted to become a paratrooper, but instead he became an army clerk. In September 62, and I think it's significant, I'm only saying it because I think it's significant, his father died unexpectedly. And in 63, at the age of 20, he had some kind of nervous breakdown, and he was eventually discharged from the US Army in early 1964, at the age of 21. He was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, chronic and severe antisocial personality disorder. But even so, he seems to lead a perfectly blameless life until September 1968, when he's by now 25, and he lures an 8-year-old girl called Tali Shapiro into his Hollywood apartment, rapes her, and beats her with a steel bar. But she doesn't die.
She doesn't die?
No.
Well, what happens to her?
Well, one of the detectives charged with finding out why she was so brutally attacked suspects Alcala might have been guilty. But there's no... It's early... We're in very early days of forensics.
No forensics.
And all of a sudden, Alcala leaves LA for New York, where he enrolls at the New York Film School as John Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R. In fact, he studies under Roman Polanski.
I'm not going to make any comments about
that. No, I didn't think you were. In July 1971, at the age of 28, he graduates from NYU and becomes a photographer called Berger, B-U-R-G-E-R.
That's not a good choice of name.
He obtained a counselling job in New Hampshire using this Berger alias. And in June 1971, a girl called Cornelia Michelle Crilly, who was a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant, was found raped and strangled in her Manhattan apartment.
In New York?
In New York. Her murder remained unsolved until 2011. The FBI had added Alcala to its list of 10 most wanted fugitives in early 1971. And a few months later, two children attending the arts camp in which he worked as a photographer.
What? Sorry, back up.
Yeah.
Why have they added him to the? How do they?
Well, it's a complicated story. He was arrested for the attack on the 8-year-old.
Okay.
Talia Shapiro.
They thought it was him, but they didn't have enough evidence
That's right.
to convict.
But now he's identified. He's working in New Hampshire. He's extradited back to Hollywood, but Tali Shapiro's parents won't allow her to act as a witness against him.
Ah, okay. So they can't. Okay.
They're unable to convict Alcala of rape and attempted murder without their primary witness. And they were forced to permit Alcala to plead guilty to the lesser charge of assault. He was paroled after 17 months.
Okay, and then he was on the... Was that when he got put on the list?
Yeah.
And then the Manhattan killing took place.
Well, no, Manhattan killing is... one of the confusions about this case is it jumps about.
Okay.
And it's not one simple line.
Okay.
Because he's committed a crime in LA, flown to New York, enrolled in film school, killed someone in New York, but they don't know it at the time.
Okay.
Then he's working in this New Hampshire arts camp.
Right, then he gets extradited.
Then the Hollywood detectives say, come back to Hollywood.
Then he gets done for assault.
He gets done for assault. But
does a few months.
Well, not long.
Yeah.
And he was paroled in 1974 what was known as the Indeterminate Sentencing Program, popular at the time, which allowed parole boards to release offenders as soon as they demonstrated evidence of rehabilitation. Less than 2 months after that release, he was rearrested after assaulting a 13-year-old girl who was identified in court only as Julie J, who had accepted what she thought was to be a ride to school. Once again, he was paroled after 2 years of another indeterminate sentence. In 1977, after his second release, his LA parole officer took the unusual step of permitting a repeat offender and a known flight risk to travel to New York City. The New York cold case detectives now believe that a week after arriving, Alcala killed a girl called Ellen Jane Hoover, H-O-V-E-R, daughter of the owner of a popular Hollywood nightclub, Ciro's, and believe it or not, the goddaughter of Dean Martin.
My goodness.
Her remains were found buried in the grounds of the Rockefeller Estate in Westchester County. This becomes even more bizarre. In 1978, Alcala goes back to LA and works for a short time at the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter and was interviewed by members of the Hillside Strangler Task Force. He was ruled out as the Hillside Strangler, but he was arrested and served a brief sentence for marijuana possession. During this period, Alcala convinced literally hundreds of young men and women that he was a professional photographer and he was photographing them for his portfolio.
Oh, no.
Yep. A Times co-worker later recalled Alcala shared his photos with his workmates. And he was quoted as saying later, "I thought it was weird, but I was young. I didn't know anything. When I asked why he took the photos, he said their moms asked him to. And I remember the girls were naked."
Yeah, obviously. A creepy guy says, I'll take your pictures.
If you take all your clothes off.
The oldest trick in the book. No, because you're like, oh, you want to be an actor? Why don't you come back to my studio? I'll do some headshots for you. Da, 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 da.
Yeah,
and then they're like, why don't you take your clothes off?
Yeah, he said he was another woman who allowed Alcala to photograph her in 1979. He said he was a professional. So in my mind, I was being a model for him. The portfolio also included spread after spread of naked teenage boys, and most of the photographs were extremely sexually explicit. Those photographs become significant because they play a part in trying to identify who his other victims were. Nevertheless, the reason he's known as the dating game killer is that in 1978, he was a contestant on a popular television show called The Dating Game.
That's like the bullseye killer.
Yeah, absolutely, except this is in America.
Mm-hmm.
The host introduced him as, and I quote, a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. He, between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling.
All rubbish.
Yes. One of the fellow contestants described him as very strange with bizarre opinions. And he won a date, though, with bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw.
Poor Cheryl.
Who subsequently refused to go out with him because she found him creepy.
Very fair. Good judgment, Cheryl.
Yes. Criminal profiler, noting that Alcala killed at least three women after his dating game appearance, speculated that his rejection might have been the exacerbating factor.
And trigger.
As one profiler put it, one wonders what that did to his mind. Well, in the period that followed, in the period between 1977 and 1979, he certainly killed at least five women. And very possibly many more. He was eventually to be tried for five killings between 77 and 79. One young woman called Robin Samso, a 12-year-old girl from Huntington Beach in California, disappeared between the beach and her ballet class in 1979. Her decomposing body was found later in the foothills, 12 days later. And Samso's friends told the police that a stranger had approached them on the beach asking to take their photographs.
He didn't have such a kind of normal MO then if it was just anybody. It was like young girls, older women, young boys, a whole variant.
Yes.
That's strange not to have a kind of normal, a set type, as it were. That's quite unusual.
It is unusual. In 1980, he was actually tried, convicted and sentenced to death for Samso's murder. But the verdict was overturned by the California Supreme Court because the jurors had been improperly informed of his prior sex crimes. In 1986, a second trial, virtually identical to the first, was held. But again, this time without the prior criminal history, he was again convicted and again sentenced to death. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal nullified the second conviction, in part because a witness was not allowed to support Alcala's contention that the park ranger who found Sam Sue's body had been hypnotised by the police investigators.
That's rubbish. But he was by this point in prison for life anyway, so these are just like continual trials to try and get him.
But the point really is, and without going, you know, one after another, one of the things that the police discovered was a storage locker in Seattle, which contained literally thousands of photographs, all put there by Alcala. Finally, in 2003, Orange County investigators, again in Los Angeles, learned that Alcala's DNA matched semen left at the rape murder scenes of two women in Los Angeles. Additional evidence, including another cold case in LA in 2004, led to his indictment for the murder of four additional women. Jill Burkham, 18, New York runaway, found rolled up like a ball in a Los Angeles ravine in 1977, originally thought to have been a victim of the Hillside Strangler. Georgia Wickstead, 27, bludgeoned in her Malibu apartment in 1977. Charlotte Lamb, 31, raped, strangled and left in the laundry room of an apartment complex in 1978. And Jill Parenteau, who was 21, and killed in her Burbank apartment. All of the bodies were found posed in carefully chosen positions. Needless to say, sexually explicit positions.
He didn't take photographs of the corpses, though, did he?
Not as far as we know.
Not that they found. That's just so such a heavy killing spree, really.
Yes. I mean,
it's sort of rampant killing, isn't it?
It is. And what makes it so frightening, and in the third trial, Alcala acted as his own attorney. He took the stand in his own defense.
We've seen that before.
Yeah. And for 5 hours, played the roles of both interrogator and witness, asking himself questions like, Mr. Alcala, and then in a deeper voice he would answer.
That's like split personality.
Yes, it is.
That's really weird.
During this bizarre self-questioning, he told the jurors, after a rambling speech, that he was at Knott's Berry Farm applying for a job as a photographer at the same time that Samso was kidnapped. He showed a portion of the 1978 dating game to the jury.
What,
yes.
With him on the show.
In an attempt to prove that the earrings found in his Seattle locker, which actually belonged to Robin Samso, were actually his. And another contestant said he never saw him wearing earrings. I would have noticed it if I had.
Yeah, of course.
He called a psychiatrist.
Do you think once you get into, and this sort of refers back to last week as well, like once you start going off down a path of like, I suppose it just depends on the psychology of the person. Like once you go down a path of starting to commit crime in that way, if you do have some kind of mental illness, it must exacerbate it to the point where you must always be justifying yourself or think, you know, your brain would start to work like in overtime.
Yeah.
So by the time you've got to court, if you're playing more than one person interrogating yourself, I suppose that's not
well
weird.
In his defense, Alcala called a psychiatrist who said that it's perfectly possible that his borderline personality disorder meant that he couldn't remember killing the women. But the prosecutor argued that he was a sexual predator who knew what he was doing and he didn't care. In March 2010, Alcala was sentenced to death for the third time. He is currently on death row in San Quentin and is now aged, of course, 74.
Is he at San Quentin?
Yeah.
Have you ever listened to the podcast Ear Hustle?
No.
It comes from San Quentin prison.
Oh, well. It's said that Alcala is now too ill to kill.
Too ill to kill.
Yeah. Although he's launched yet another series of appeals.
They do a very interesting episode of Ear Hustle about aging in prison.
Oh, well, I should listen. But, I mean, after his 2010 conviction, there were all sorts of attempts to identify Alcala as the killing. There's, of course, Cornelia Crilly, the TWA flight attendant. There's the goddaughter of Dean Martin. And in 2012, he was taken from LA to New York. Again, he entered not guilty pleas to both counts, but in December, he changed both pleas to guilty, citing a desire to return to California to pursue his appeals against the death penalty there. And in January 2013, a Manhattan, New York attorney judge gave him another 25 years to life, as the death penalty had not been an option in New York State since 2007. He's a person of interest in crimes in Washington State, in San Francisco, in Wyoming. The list of possible victims is just extraordinary. It's incredible, and it's all over the country. And all the way back to that first attack on Tali Shapiro back in 1968. So it's breathtaking how prolific.
Mm.
And what's so terrifying too about him is that he literally took a great delight in torturing the women, half killing them, bringing them back round, half killing them again, bringing them round before. You know, he's a grotesque,
truly evil,
truly depraved, evil man. they've made a biographical film about him for the television network in America called Investigation Discovery. I mean, there is something utterly, utterly depraved about Alcala. And I think it makes him, for me, no one really compares with Bundy, but, or I suppose John Wayne Gacy, but he's a very prolific, brutal killer who was eventually convicted of killing five, but almost certainly killed
many more
women. And if anything underlines my feeling, that say, as I always say at the end of these shows, bad things happen to good people. Not one of these victims deserved any kind of fate like this. Not one. And the girl who takes a lift to the, you know, I'll give you a lift to school, or the girls on the beach, or the a flight attendant in her apartment, or the girl in the Burbank apartment in Hollywood. Yeah, none of that. No one deserves that fate. Mm. No one. And it's the sheer cynicism of it, the sheer...
Do you think someone would get away with that now? They wouldn't really, would they? Because policing and forensics and everything's changed so much. Not on that scale.
I doubt they'd get away with it on that scale. But people have got away with it.
Yeah.
Do I think that it's possible that, given modern DNA, given the tense forensic developments, it's possible for a serial killer to exist? Yes, I do. If you're really focused, and that's what your intent is, yes, I do think it's possible. But you'd have to be prepared to move around a lot.
Yeah.
Because the old thing about connecting the dots, we've talked about it many times, your police cooperation.
Yeah, because he was advantaged of the fact that not crossing state lines thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've even seen it in Britain. You know,
yeah.
One police authority not really immediately connecting up with another. The Central Homes database, which we've had, you know, post the Yorkshire Ripper, you know, the Home Office's major inquiry computer. Yes, that connects the dots, but it's still possible for there to be people out there. I am convinced that if you're determined and you are forensically aware, it is possible to get away with murder.
Well, that was really interesting. Thank you,
Dad. It is an interesting case, that one.
Yeah, really interesting.
And
I didn't know about it, but it's obviously a big deal in America.
It's a very big deal in America.
Mm. Cool. Thank you very much.
But he could stand trial in Wyoming, but apparently he's too ill to travel as well as to kill. He could stand trial in Marin County in San Francisco. He is a ruthless killing machine. And he looks, I'll just dial up my photograph for you.
Oh, he's weird looking. He's got a big moustache and he's very skinny, but that photo's taken a long time ago.
That's
his mugshot.
Yeah. It's back from 97. When was that taken? 97. That was taken in 97.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, you know.
Yeah, quite a long time ago.
I suspect he's now very, very, you know, gaunt indeed.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Because I think a long time in prison can do that to you. But, oh dear. You can see how attractive he might have been. He's not bad looking. He might have offered some of these young people marijuana at one point or another. He certainly used a lot of it himself.
Might have had cannabis psychoses.
He might. I'm always very cautious about that one. Yeah, I think it's possible, but what came first, the chicken or the egg?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, not from then. Nowadays it's different because cannabis is so strong and it's got all full of chemicals and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, I don't know the science of it.
Yes. The collection of more than 1,000 photographs of women and teenage boys, many in sexually explicit poses, He took a delight.
In
it.
Yeah.
He took absolute pleasure in it.
I think I've had enough of him.
Well, we should. I have to say, I don't blame you.
I think we should shut him down.
Okay. Well, that is Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer.
Thanks, Dad.
Well, I don't know.
Well, you know, I thank you for doing the work, but that was pretty gruesome.
It's grim. Have you got any great plans for next week, apart from poor Betsy recovering?
No, not really. Just working away, the usual, you know. Not much. It's January, you know, so it's quiet.
Yeah.
I'll take quiet.
Will you?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like to see this coming week over.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Well,
it will soon be out the other side, and
it's not the cheeriest of weeks for me.
No, I know. But it will be February soon, and then, you know, and also it's lovely weather today, so there are a few...
Well, that's always great.
Small mercies there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you as ever to you, Geoffrey, for all of your hard work and... telling the story. Thank you to all the people who look after us, to our producer Poppy Damon, my brother Dan who makes the music, my friend Barney who helps us with the sound, Hannah who I work with and is my friend and helps us with all things podcast, and to Audio Boom for hosting us. Thanks so much. Please like and subscribe, leave a review, do anything you can to help us up our listens. We are hugely grateful.
We are deeply grateful, and we aren't joking, it's absolutely true. We are so grateful to everyone who takes the trouble to listen, and
we really are, and we would love to hear from you.
Yes.
bloodties.podcast@gmail.com or on Twitter or Instagram at bloodties_pod.
Well, that's just brilliant, and thank you all, and as I say, bad things do happen to good people, so do be careful out there.